Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. You know, I just got off a phone call, an early morning call from a client that apparently is in an audit at the moment. It's a medical device of some sort. And I don't know all of the details, but I've known this person for a number of years in different companies. And they were saying, we did a verification run of our process. It was part of our making sure everything was ready to go to production. And the auditor is second guessing what we did. And the question was, should we have used control charts or a lot sampling or some other method to run our verification? And it was really around understanding the variability that's inherent in your process. And I was like, you know, there's a whole pile of ways you could go about doing that. But and then we had a short discussion about, well, what were you trying to achieve? You know, and at first it was like, well, we knew we had to do a verification. And I'm like, why? I mean, was there a reason that you have to do it? And it was, the argument was, well, the auditor, the FDA and the auditors typically want you to do that kind of test. So we feel like we have to. I'm like, okay, well, it's okay. Good enough.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, it goes to that much larger piece. And what you and I talk about all the time is, well, how do you pick the right tool for what you're trying to, you know, for your plan? Right. And it's certainly not, I think we talked about the last time we talked, is you don't take the mill standard 785 and just do everything in it. No, you don't do that.
No, but, you don't.
But it leaves open the question of, when you open up 785, there's a bunch of really cool things in there you can do. Right. Well, why wouldn't you want to do all those things? And it brings up the question as well, how do you choose which ones to do?
And yeah, what are the selection criteria? That's a great topic, and it's not trivial. Oftentimes the selection criteria becomes what you've done in the past because you're comfortable with it or you're trained in it,
yeah,
or what your boss wants to see.
That's
or
right.
In this case, that the story you're talking about, what the auditor or the regulatory body typically wants to see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not trivial. I mean, you have to comply with regulations, and you also have to comply with your management, usually.
Well, yeah, don't tell
not
me
always,
that.
Not always. and similarly, you have to consider, let's put it that way, you have to consider what your customer wants. So if you have a customer like the Department of Defense or an OEM, and they're looking for something that may guide you to use this particular tool.
Mm-hmm.
So this conversation goes down to, what are the influencers? And then if you don't have any influence, like there's no customer demanding, then what is best practice? How do you select the different tools?
Yeah. And I think it's where we get into the best practice, where we don't have a lot of constraints that, you know, if your customer comes in and says, do this, here's the standard, we want you to run this test and we'll judge that. Well, then just do that test and give them the results and you're done, right? The hard part is that when you got to think through, well, what do we need to do? What are we trying to do?
You're right. That is the hard part. And let's focus on that, because the other subject is another podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for instance, if your customer says, we're going to be using MTBF, and you don't necessarily automatically comply, you may have a dialogue with them,
mm-hmm,
as to what are you trying to achieve, what, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
But that's a different subject. Let's say, for the purpose of talking today, you have the opportunity to select tools. Well, then how do you go about it?
That's right.
And one thing we could do is just let's brainstorm right now 5 or 6 common tools that show up in a lot of reliability plans, and just ask each other, what's the criteria that triggers those tools? So how about we go back and forth? I'll FMEA will be one of them.
Oh, imagine that. You would mention FMEA. Don't you have a book on that or something?
Maybe.
All right, I'll speak for Kirk then. HALT, H-A-L-T.
Okay. Right. So we got FMEA, we got HALT. Let me try requirements allocation.
Requirements allocation. So like...
Reliability allocation.
Okay.
Flow down system to subsystem to components.
Okay. So a tool in that could be like reliability block diagram, for example.
Okay, RBD.
Yeah, okay. ALT, estimating the life. And that's just a part, you know, as we're going down this, I'm thinking of accelerated life testing, but there's also predictions and estimates and field data analysis that all can achieve the same objective of what an ALT does, is to give you an estimate of time to failure. Distribution. All right. So there's four.
Okay.
There's also, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just figured out the fourth one. Fault tree analysis.
Okay. A fault tree analysis. Okay. And failure analysis.
Failure analysis. Okay.
FA. So, you know, as I'm looking at each one of these things, like FMEA, to me, is one. It's in and of itself, as you know, since you wrote the book on it, has many, many different applications and uses, from design FMEA and system FMEA, and you can focus on a particular aspect of your software, functional level. It can be grand and glorious, and everybody's involved in it. It's a huge project, but it has great impact and return, or it could be pulled off the shelf for an hour quickly in a meeting to help prioritize a few things, right? As a strategy to prioritize what do we need to address. In and of itself, though, the tool is flexible, but it's part of a larger set of tools to me.
What's the larger set?
Risk identification and prioritization.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay, so you have your risk identification tools. And that's a category. That's a bucket.
Yeah,
and I recall that from our other dialogues we've had. We had four different buckets of tools. But now with during the requirements bucket, you might use different tools like FMEA or fault tree analysis risk reduction bucket.
But I think along with FMEA, people often associate, there's enterprise risk management, which is everything from scenario planning to FMEA to hazard analysis there's a lot of different styles of viewing what do we need to prioritize on, what do we need to prepare for, or what are, those kinds of things. But you could even lump in a tool like physics of failure into it, saying we're going to run these failure mechanism models to see if they apply for our application. And that's a way to identify risk, right? It's a little more detailed, right? It's not what we always do, but you could say in risk identification that a mechanical engineer does a finite element model to find out if he has an unwarranted or an unusually high stress concentration. He's identifying the risk of stress concentrations as they lead to cracking or whatever.
Okay, so the dialogue here is saying we need to know what it is we're trying to find out, what decisions we're trying to make, or what information we're trying to bring about. So that's part of the selection of a tool. So before you even consider a tool, you should be asking yourself, what are we trying to achieve? What are we trying to learn? Or what decisions are we trying to make?
Right. And so for the risk identification ones, or the risk ones, and FMEA is a piece of this, I think there's really two parts to that. There are two types of questions that we're trying to answer, is what don't I know, right? What's the uncertainty here? What is it that is unclear or fuzzy or unknown right now? And so think of the mechanical engineer saying, there's 47 ways this can fail, and everyone of them keeps me up at night, but I can only solve three. Which ones are the most important? Right? FMEA would be a reasonable tool for that, to prioritize, because then you're including severity and probabilities or occurrences and stuff, right?
Yeah. If you're concerned about risk, that puts you in the risk reduction tools. In other words, you want to reduce risk about for a particular project or design. Then what steers you towards FMEA? The way I look at it is the degree of change. So I look at a few different factors, mm-hmm. more than one factor, but one is degree of change, the other is field history, and the other is the amount of new technology. And so those are three factors that I consider. If you have a lot, if you have new technology and you're making a significant change from the previous version, or you have significant field problems from the past and you're creating a new design, that tends to push me towards an FMEA. What do you think?
Well, I think everything pushes you towards an FMEA, to be honest,
no,
Carl.
No, it's not true.
That's not true. No, I think you're right. I think the FMEA in the risk identification thing, and I use the word risk almost synonymous with uncertainty, right? So yeah. A new technology. Well, we don't really even know how it fails. Now, I could, if my main question is, well, how does this fail? If I get together five or six experts that know nothing about how this material behaves at temperature, I'm better served to go do a halt test, or go do halt, right? Go step it up in temperature until I see what fails. If we have a pretty good idea that there's a lot of ways it can fail, and we have some prior history or information or the appropriate experts in the room that have that walking knowledge, then we can, FMEA is the right tool, right?
Well, this is good though. Let's shift now. You brought up halt. So what would steer you to say we want to do a halt project?
I don't know how it fails. I need to understand what are my, or two things. One question is, what will fail? Just here's a device or a new gadget or a new design or a new prototype. Do we know how it's going to fail? And what are the ways it can fail? Those kinds of questions. Let's go make it fail. Apparently, you could give it to a 12-year-old girl with a short back pocket for her cell phone, and you could experiment that way with your phone real quick. But mm-hmm. in most of us, we want to find out in some reasonable way, do we have all of the – and so it overlaps with that risk identification one. Do we know how it's going to fail? Will it fail catastrophically, right? Will it fail and cause a safety hazard? Will it fail and be a problem in some way or non-recoverable or, you know, those kind of we have an uncertainty about like a new technology. How will it fail to work?
So the uncertainty of how it will fail, but then there's some other criteria. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're not using halt, correct me if I'm wrong here, but for a concern about software.
Well, you can halt software. You don't.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't mean you stick it in a high temperature chamber, but we used to do it with networking equipment. We had a series of servers that would load that network device and step up the traffic and step up the frequency, the speed of the traffic and the types of traffic and so on. And we'd look for error packets. And at some point you get a threshold where there's too many errors. And that's a failure of that software handling the packet flow, for example.
Very good. And this is kind of where I'm probing is the concept of halt.
Oh yeah.
In other words, without the halt chamber. In other words, it's not the traditional
circuit board and temperature and humidity.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is the concept. But the other piece that halt is really good at, it ties more. Do I have the appropriate margin? So do I understand my product well enough to say I have a 2x margin on this, right? So it's taking a load and my design is such that I need a 2x safety factor on it. So instead of 1,000 pounds, it can handle 2,000 pounds, right? Running it in a halt is a great way to see, do I fail at 1,000, at 2,000 pounds, or do I fail some other point? Do I have margin, right? And so that concept of step stress out to failure is a way to measure those boundaries and areas. And if it's inside our criteria, then we have work to do. We made some bad assumptions someplace, or we didn't design it appropriately, or we have Excellent. A, you know, whereas there, I mean, so it can be used in a variety of ways, but part of it for halt and I call them discovery tools. I think, no offense to Dr. Hobbs, but it was it's really a bad acronym. Too many people, and we could talk about that at length, too many people think you can pass that test and all that other stuff. It's really, there's a whole class of tools from, and you've seen it, Carl, you get their first prototype back and it sits on the designer's desk and they poke it and prod it and move it and operate it in different ways. And they say, all right, I should be getting 10 volts here. Do I actually get 10 volts here? It's 9.8. Is that reasonable or not? Let me change the configuration a little bit. No, okay, now I'm getting 6 volts. That's clearly not right. Some people call that playing or tinkering, right? But they're really setting a whole series of hypotheses. Here's the response I expect. Did I get it? So it's an experiment. Now, when we put stress on it, right, we start saying we're going to add some temperature, we're going to add some load, we're going to add some fast chip or a slow chip, for example, in electronic circuits, or we're going to add altitude for the cooling system, or we're going to do whatever. We're running an experiment. We're trying to discover either more information about what we think we know to confirm it, right? Think of the Boeing aircraft when they do the wing test, right? They do all this massive modeling. They set up this big test with this one wing and they bend it until it fractures. And if it fractures where they expect, when it, they expect it, under what load and deflection that it should do, they confirm their models. If it goes beyond it, well, they were a little conservative. If it fails well before it, then it's probably not a good design. You know, we got work to do.
Right. So discovery is a very key part of risk reduction. And it's different than, are you good enough? It's basically learning. It's the subject of failures. It's knowing what your margins are, to some degree what your margins are. And like you say, explaining how it fails.
That's right. So that's a whole class of, I think it overlaps with risk identification type things. And it's really aimed at, like you said, learning to reduce the uncertainty of what we know and don't know. But HALT has the capability, that concept has the capability to reveal things you didn't know you didn't know, which is really, really useful, of our tools.
Well, there's the HALT and then the quantitative accelerated life testing. And so call it qualitative accelerated testing and quantitative. And there's a difference there. And one might be used in one portion of the product development process and the other in a different portion of the product development process. And so that's a different subject. Are you trying to calculate the exact reliability, or are you probing to learn and discover what your potential failures are?
Yeah, and you know, and they feed into each other. If I don't know what the failure mechanism is that it will limit the life of the product, it's really hard to set up a accelerated life test to quantify the time to failure, because the acceleration is contingent on the failure mechanism.
Exactly.
Right? So those tie together. So oftentimes you see this progression of the tools we've just talked about is you do the organized brainstorming types of tools like FMEA to say, well, where do we see the risks are? What do we, in our engineering judgment, consider to be the top priorities? And what do we know or not know about? And then we supplement it with, well, are we right? Did we find the right failure mechanism? Do we have margins there? And then you find something that says, well, this is on the edge. It might last long enough. It might not. Let's go quantify that. Here's the failure mechanism. Let's run that test.
And this is an important aspect, because there's selection of tools and then there's the timing of the tools. Mm-hmm. So some of these tools you want to do really early. So you discover more, you learn more, and then now you understand better the failure mechanisms. Now you can do more modeling and you can get into more quantitative aspects of those mechanisms. So the timing is important. What about fault tree? Just taking another example here.
Yeah.
Well, so you have FMEA and then sometimes you have fault tree. So what triggers a fault tree?
Well, you mentioned modeling early. You know, it's part of, I think, to me, what triggers modeling and fault trees. One example of reliability Bach diagram, fault tree, Petri net, Markov modeling. There's even Monte Carlo based modeling of system reliability, availability modeling, all kinds of stuff. The the triggers it is, I think two things again. I'm big on two today. Maybe I've had two cups of coffee. It might be it. One is that you want to allocate your objectives, your like a reliability goal. The example I always use is one I can remember is you got a computer and it has five major subsystems in it, and we're going to buy a hard drive, right? Well, we want to tell the hard drive vendor how reliable their part has to be to meet our overall system goal. So we apportion or break down, and a block diagram works great for that. Fault tree could be used for it. It's not a model that's commonly used for that allocation, but it could be. And the idea is that you want to do the math that, well, if I know my power supply is this good and these other parts are this good, then how good does the hard drive have to be to make the system goal? Well, a system reliability model of some sort helps you calculate that. So part of it is the setting requirements and specifications and expectations for the subsystems and major components in your system, your product. The other part is, and I've seen it done very effectively, is, well, we're looking for cost reduction. You know, which parts can I reduce the reliability of and save some money possibly, but not affect the overall failure rate? That's a trickier one.
So once you have it modeled.
Right.
So the interesting, let me build off the rule of two here that you're talking about today. So fault tree has two aspects to it. One is the modeling, and you're absolutely correct. The modeling of fault tree is very similar mathematically to reliability block diagram.
Right.
And so that mathematics has a similarity. But there's something unique that says when we want to do a fault tree, and I think it has to do with you have a significant unwanted event.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Something really big is on the landscape that you don't want to have happen, some safety issue or some performance issue that has more than one way you can get to it. In other words, it has more than one path that often happen in tandem, and then fault tree becomes a modeling. So it's not a set of discrete independent events.
Right.
It's the dependent events that A plus B happens. It something like that drives you towards a fault tree if you have that unwanted event.
Yeah, and it, you know, where I see that more often is where you don't want a single point failure. So a fault tree and associate kinds of models allow you to look for those single point failure locations in your design or in your system. But I also find to build on that though, is that if you have a good fault tree, like car doesn't start. I'm thinking of when I walk up my driveway, my car doesn't start.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, it could be this, and the battery being dead since the door was open and the dome light was probably on. It's probably I left the door open and the battery drained, right? But you listen to the way the ignition, at least in an internal combustion engine, you can hear, is it a dead battery? Is it a bad alternator? Do I have fuel? Mm-hmm. You can pick up clues that give you probabilities of which path you're most likely to occur. So that's a fault tree. So it could be used, once you have a model in place, you can use it to troubleshoot or diagnose what's the source of the failure this time. Especially when, like you mentioned, there's many underlying mechanisms or paths to cause the top level, hey, it doesn't start. Doesn't turn
right,
on. It's
right.
Like your microphone earlier today.
Yes, indeed. One of my favorite fault trees was when I was a GM, is we did a fault tree called Never Leaves Me Stranded.
Ah, good.
Similar to the one you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. But all the different ways you could be stranded in a vehicle.
That's right.
And then start designing the vehicle so that you'll minimize the probability of being stranded. And that's one of the advantages of fault tree, is you can actually get to it. Probability of unwanted event, mm-hmm. which you do not get to in a FMEA.
That's right. That's right. And so it's the modeling, though, has a lot of different triggers. If you want to do what if scenarios, what if I change the architecture? How does that affect the overall availability? How do I achieve high availability? Do I emphasize faster maintenance, ease of maintenance, or do I emphasize mm-hmm. higher reliability? So the what if scenarios in design and as it impacts reliability is perfect for block diagrams, fault trees, and other models. But it's also used reverse-wise as setting up your maintenance schedule or looking for diagnostic equipment or so on. It has so many different... In modeling, I also throw in physics of failure. It's a model right. of a failure mechanism.
Yes, right? Indeed.
It's very specific, but you can do what-if stuff, you can do prediction stuff with it and so on, but it fits into so many other models and so many other scenarios. That, you know, that's kind of the hard part here, Carl, is that each one of these tools, and whether you break it down by life cycle or you break it down by categories of tools, is they overlap and have so many versatile uses. I think that just adds so much complexity to it.
And let me frame this for listeners right now. As Fred and I are talking about different tools and what is selection criteria, and we don't have time in a podcast to cover all the different tools. The point of it is for listeners to take away is that each tool has certain selection criteria. You don't have to be an expert in every tool, although that would be great if you were, mm-hmm. but you don't have to be. You at least need to know what are the selection and the trigger criteria for the tool, because then you can then bring in the expert for that tool. So if you're not an expert in reliability modeling of some type of mechanism, you at least need to know when you need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is the reliability engineering expertise that's so important, is to know the various tools well enough so you know when you do one versus the other. And if you can become expert in that, you don't have to be expert in every tool, because you can bring in the expertise at the right time.
That's right. You know, and the one we didn't mention was failure analysis, which I think is more obvious than many of them.
Yes, it is. That has a unique trigger.
Yeah, that's right. Something fails.
Yes.
But you're exactly right, Carl, is that we have such, and we only talked about the things that are predominantly considered reliability related, but we have control charts and process capability and change management and presentation skills and writing skills and I guess all the communication skills. And then there's engineering stuff. If you're in the polymer sciences, then polymer engineering comes to play. And depending on your industry, there's a good Indeed. Reliability engineer also has a good knowledge, maybe not as capable as the design engineers themselves, but you know, many great reliability folks have come out of the design world and they can talk that language. They understand the constraints and the pushbacks and the trade-offs and could sit down and create a design if they really needed to. And so I think what we outlined today were the selection of generally considered reliability specific tools. Of course, it's fuzzy around the edges, but there's many more that make up what we do and put in plans and so on.
And as a listener, if you have questions about what triggers certain tools, or if you have input to this discussion as to how you select different tools, please get in touch with us. And Fred, how do they do that?
I'm surprised you don't know this yet, Carl. It's ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form for us there. Or you can find us, certainly you can find us on LinkedIn and on the about pages at Ascendo Reliability. We try to make ourselves available so that we can have you join the conversation. And we certainly appreciate your input and feedback and ideas.
Very good. Great discussion.
All right. Thanks, Carl. That went quick.
Man, it did.
Yeah, you got me going there with that MTBF thing. You're lucky it didn't.
I guess you're energized.
That's it. All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.